Well, perhaps you could turn back to Ecclesiastes and chapter 12. I didn't get any of these things in my Christmas stocking, although you may well think that I should have done. L'Oreal Advanced Anti-Aging and Anti-Sagging Cream. L'Oreal Anti-Wrinkle and Anti-Firming. Estee Lauder Advanced Night Repair Synchronized Recovery Cream. The anti-aging industry is thriving. The global market, apparently in 2016, was worth £200 billion. And increasing at 6% per year. It's big business. People will pay for it. But why is the industry such a winner? Perhaps it's because beauty and health and youth have become some of the gods of our society. The things that people value very highly. And if you have these gods, these things that you worship, then you will do everything that you can to protect and preserve them. But here's the difficult thing. These gods are all being dismantled by age. Joan Collins, who was a British actress, once said this: "The problem with beauty is that it's like being born rich and becoming poor." And Ecclesiastes chapter 12 warns us that whatever creams you may buy or surgery you may take, you lose in the end. And there's this poetic description, isn't there, within the chapter about what it's like to grow older. The grinders cease, verse 3, your teeth, because they are few. And those that look through the windows grow dim. You need to go to Specsavers, and your eyesight goes in the end, doesn't it? That's what it's like as you grow old. The chapter doesn't Disneyfy the process. It's very challenging. As they say, aging is not for wimps. And that's not the worst of it, because aging has a direction and it has a terminus. And if you look in verse 7, this is the bottom line to it all. Going back to Genesis chapter 3, isn't it? Dust you are, and to dust you will return. Once read about Chris Patton. He was a cabinet minister, I guess, back in the 70s, 80s. And he was actually the last governor of Hong Kong. But when he was chancellor, as he once was, of Oxford University, he sent a copy of his autobiography to the Chancellor of Cambridge University, who at the time was the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip. And the title of his autobiography that he sent to Prince Philip was "What Next?" And Prince Philip wrote back to him and said just this: "What next? When you're my age, there's only one answer." Actually, for all of us, the answer to the question, what next, is, don't know. Don't know what will happen. Don't know how long I'll be here. 10 years? 50 years? Maybe just next week. So don't count on tomorrow. And don't think that this passage, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, is a passage that's exclusively for senior citizens. One way that you could summarize it might just be this. You may be young, but one day you will be old. And one day you will die. You'd be a fool not to be ready for that. So I wanted to look at three things this morning from the chapter, three headings. These are the headings. Verse 1, he is your creator, therefore remember him. Verse 14, he is your judge, therefore fear him. Verse 11, he is your shepherd, therefore follow him. Let's look at verse 1 then, the first of those. He is your creator. When you come to a Bible passage, it's always a reasonable start to ask some very basic questions about the passage, because sometimes the answer to a simple question can be quite revealing. So, first one, younger ones, who are you to remember? Simple question. What's the answer? Yes. Yes, but it doesn't say that, does it, in verse 1? What's the word that it uses? Remember who? Who's going to tell me? Who is it? Yeah. No, that's interesting. And in some ways, that's a bit of a surprise, because in the book of Ecclesiastes, that word, creator, has not appeared at all until this very last chapter. And in this very last chapter, the writer uses it twice. It's there in verse 1, and it's there in verse 6. Remember your creator, both times. So it makes you think, why now? Why say now, remember your creator? Why doesn't he just say, remember your God? There are times when you choose words to convey a message, even though you don't state it directly. And it's all the more powerful for it. An example. In 1966, President Charles de Gaulle of France had taken France out of the military command structure of NATO. And as a result of that, he demanded that all US troops be taken off French soil. The US President, Lyndon Johnson, at the time, he sent a message back to de Gaulle, which said this, or questioned this. Did his order to remove all US troops from French soil also include the 60,000 plus soldiers buried in France from World War I and World War II? Or what he was really saying was, you owe us for what we've given. And here in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, when the writer says, remember your creator, he's reminding us, you owe. I made you. I gave you life. What's your response to that? Well, we know what it should be, don't we? It's not that worship is something that's alien to us at all, but something's happened. And that something that's happened to a large majority of mankind is something that's described to us in Romans chapter 1 and verse 25. You can turn to it if you want. Romans 1:25 is talking about people who have, to quote, exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creator, the creature, rather than the creator who is blessed forever. So what it's saying, Romans 1:25, is that man has done a trick here. He's introduced some exchange mechanism. We know he should worship the creator, but instead he exchanges the worship of the creator for the worship of the creature or created things, things you see, feel, touch, and so on. He's exchanged those two things. Or in a bigger sense, what he's done is he has exchanged the truth of God for what is a lie. And if you reject the worship of the Lord God, and if you will not remember your creator, then in effect, Romans is telling to us here, you are living life under a false premise. You're living a lie. Your maker demands your worship, and you will refuse it. Now, here's another simple question from the passage. In fact, still in verse 1 of the passage, we said, who is it we should remember? Remember your creator. But when should you remember your creator? Who's going to tell me? Look at verse 1. The answer is there. It's very simple. There's no catch in this. When should you remember your creator? In the days of your youth. It's right. Now, some of you did that, and some of you are doing that. But what if you didn't? And what if you never have? Well, it's never too late. But why do it in the days of your youth? I mean, why can't you have some kind of different policy? Why don't you just put it off when you're young? Why don't you just kick it into the long grass and come back to it later? I think there are reasons why that wording is there. Let me tell you just a few. Suppose a church group, maybe 10, 15 people, go into a care home. There's lots of old people in this care home sitting there in the dining room waiting for this service to start. And part of the church group, one of the younger members stands up and talks about how knowing the Lord Jesus has absolutely changed and transformed their lives and so on. And afterwards, the minister gets up and he gives this wonderful word, 5 or 10 minutes. And, you know, it is so compelling and so challenging. And you look around afterwards at all of those people who are gathered there. And after the testimony and after the preaching and so on, and it does not appear to have made the slightest difference to anybody. Now, there are reasons for that. But amongst those reasons are the fact that some of them can't hear, and some of them can't reason, and some of them, well, it's just too much water under the bridge. Can't change now as they see it. You see? Remember your creator. When do you do it? In the days of your youth. While you can still think clearly. Before too much of life has gone on. What else does it say? Well, it says verse 6, doesn't it? All these metaphors here. Before the silver cord is loosed, golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the well. They're all things that are easily broken. What's it speaking to us about? Well, actually, it's saying life is easily broken. And you know that, don't you? Some of you here, I'm quite sure, will have known somebody this year who died unexpectedly. It was a sudden illness, or a slip, or an accident, or a moment of carelessness. Life is fragile. Therefore, remember him, your creator, now, while you have life. And maybe a third reason. Do you ever regret things? You know, this is for the older ones. Do you ever wish? When I was a teenager, why did I not take a musical instrument? Or why didn't I play that sport or do that pastime or something like that? You wish, looking back, you'd done it. But in the final analysis, maybe it didn't make too much of a difference to your life. But if you do not do this verse one thing in your youth, it will make a difference. It will make a huge difference. Because if you don't remember your Creator in the days of your youth, then you won't read about him. You won't read the Bible. That makes sense, doesn't it? Why would you do that if you don't remember him? Now, what kind of words do you find in the Bible? Well, we could have lots of descriptions about these kind of words, couldn't you? But let's just stick to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. What does it say here about these words? Look at verse 9 onwards. What are these words like? They're words of truth. They're words of wisdom. They're words of correction, aren't they? But if you don't remember your Creator, these words will never cross your path. You'll live your life in a spiritual wilderness. Now, you might say, what's the big deal about that? Why is that important? Well, it's important, I think, in a way, because of verse 8. Look at verse 8. Verse 8 is the big refrain, theme tune of the book of Ecclesiastes. Vanity. Life's like this. It can appear empty to people. Transitory. Unsatisfactory. Now, you know life can be like that, don't you? It's complicated. It's difficult to negotiate. There are things you can't explain. There are injustices go on. Life goes round and round in circles at times. You feel like you're getting nowhere on things. And life passes you by so incredibly quickly as well. In short, there will be periods of your life when you struggle to make sense of it all. And so you say to yourself, I need all the help I can get. But when you don't remember your Creator, like it says here in the chapter, whatever stage you're at, you wave goodbye to the possibility of understanding why you're here, or how you're here, or what you should be doing. What does it mean to remember? It means to call to mind and take appropriate action. What kind of appropriate action should you take? Well, there's one thing you can do in our next heading. And what we said, he is your judge, therefore fear him. Now, if we were to go out into the Intu Center today and maybe take some kind of straw poll with people and said to them, what do you think happens to you after you die? What do you think they'd say? What do you think would be the majority response to those kind of questions? I think the majority of people would say, well, what happens to you after you die is either oblivion, it's lights out, you don't know about it, nothing happens, you cease to exist, brain death, and so on. That's one possibility. And some people might also say, well, it's not that. It is instead the certainty of paradise for everybody. Everyone is on the bus, if you like. This thought of judgment here, well, that's, they might say this. They'd say, well, that's just thinking from the Dark Ages. But views like that have absolutely no data, do they? They're just a hunch. They're just what you think. They're just what you make up. They're just what satisfies you. Far better than speculation is the revelation that you get here in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 14 tells us just this, that judgment is coming and judgment is comprehensive. There's no secrets, nothing left out, nothing missed. Now, it's not telling you this simply to increase your knowledge base about the Bible. Because verse 13 and verse 14 are a package. They work together. Verse 13 is action. Verse 14 is rationale, reasoning for their action. So it's saying to us, fear God, keep his commandments, because judgment is coming. Judgment is on the way. Now, if we'd had the time to read through all of Ecclesiastes, then the statement that it makes in verse 14 might make us just a little bit uncomfortable. Turn back just a few pages to Ecclesiastes and chapter 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 20. Remember what we just had? We just had, fear God, keep his commandments, because judgment's coming. Verse 20, chapter 7, there is not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin, or does not break his commandments. Now that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it's saying to us, chapter 12, fear God, keep his commandments, because judgment's on the way. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, it's saying, well, actually, the number of people who can do this is a null set. Nobody. Rianne, nothing. None of us. It's a puzzle, isn't it? So how do you solve the puzzle? Two seemingly irreconcilable statements, both true, but how can they work out? The reason they don't appear to at this stage is because here, Book of Ecclesiastes, still Old Testament, we do not have a complete theology revealed to us at this point. The answer will come to us in the New Testament. And that's the third heading. Remember the third heading? He is your shepherd, therefore follow him. Now, the shepherd motif is there consistently throughout the Bible. And we have it here, don't we, in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads, the words of scholars are like well-driven nails, given by one shepherd. Apparently, the words in Ecclesiastes, actually the words of the whole of the Bible, given by one shepherd. But who is that shepherd? That's the question, isn't it? Turn to John chapter 10. John's Gospel and chapter 10. John chapter 10 has more references to the shepherd than any other chapter in the New Testament. Who is the shepherd? Who's speaking here? Verse 7. Jesus said to them. Now remember the puzzle we had in Ecclesiastes? What was the puzzle? Heading for judgment, and I know beyond any doubt whatsoever that I am guilty. That's my problem. How are you going to solve that problem? Well, what if I'm guilty? Acknowledge that. What if I'm guilty, but I'm acquitted because somebody else who is innocent steps up, to take the sentence in my place. How do I know somebody will do that? How do I know somebody can do that? Because it's here in John chapter 10. Just look at verse 11. John chapter 10 and verse 11 is the answer to the puzzle and enigma of Ecclesiastes chapter 12. I'm guilty, facing judgment. How can I escape? God knows everything about me. I can only escape if an innocent person steps up and takes the sentence. Who is such an innocent person? Maybe it's the shepherd. Jesus the shepherd is speaking here. What does he say? John chapter 10 verse 11. He says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Gives it up. Innocent man in my place for the guilty. That's the answer, you see. Conundrum in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, solved in John chapter 10. So what do we say? In summary, every day you are settling the question, how can I live now so that old age will be sweet and not bitter to my soul? Because things are fading in my life. Power, strength, intellect, health, all being eroded by old age. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with Judgment Day? Ecclesiastes says, fear God, keep his commandments. But that's not all. Got to go over into the New Testament. And the New Testament shows me how I can properly do that by repenting and following the Good Shepherd who laid down his life, and by listening to his voice.